Hello, welcome to InvestStream live with Rahul Chandra and Ankita Vashisht. Today we're going to be talking about the rise of VC in India. Ankita, Rahul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Sankesh. Thank you.
It's been a while. I've had a chance to catch up with both of you, so this is a good excuse. So Ankita, let's start with you. You are the founder of the Saha Fund. It's a women-focused fund out of India. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and Saha Fund? What prompted you to start Saha Fund? When, you know, your portfolio thesis? Let's start with that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I'll just give you a quick background. So I come from a engineering and finance background, and very quickly got into private equity, starting off and working in London for a CDC-owned fund called Aureus Capital. At that time, it was a $2 billion fund looking to invest in the emerging markets, sector agnostic, but investing in the regions like Asia, Africa, Latin America. So during my time there, I did global portfolio management and also global fundraising. And we kind of successfully raised money for three funds at that time, which was an Asia, an India fund, a Southeast Asia fund, and an Africa. Hi. Okay. You know, so I got a great experience of looking into the emerging markets. I was there for a couple of years and then kind of wanted to move back into the region, so I moved to Singapore and India, and I said, okay, I'm very interested and passionate about bringing, solutions, innovative solutions into Asia. But I want to work with younger teams, you know, who are working with new tech, have fresh ideas. And really kind of building solutions, you know, and solving real world problems. So I set up my first fund that time called Thalons Capital, which was investing in early stage tech companies in India, Singapore, US and Philippines. And from there, I also launched an innovation lab called Wavemaker Labs, which was based in Singapore and was funded by the Singapore government under the technology incubation scheme, which did very, very well. You know, one of our companies called Luxola became Asia's biggest online cosmetic store and got sold to Sephora. And that was a woman founder. Also at that point, you know, I joined a bunch of angel networks. Of course, today there's like so many angel networks, but at that time there were very few, and one of them was Indian Angel Network. You know, where you have these monthly meetings, you meet companies. And I realized while I was there that, you know, there'd be these monthly meetings and there'd be 50 investors coming in, but I was the only woman, right? And also if there were, male and female co-founded companies, always the male co-founder would be the CEO or they would present. So then I realized there's this huge gap that needs to be addressed in terms of, you know, having funding available for women-led companies, but also having women investors, right, to be able to make these investments. So that's when I said, okay, I want to do my next fund now, but I really want to have, a focus that I feel can really make a difference, can really address a gap. So that's when I launched Saha Fund in 2016 to invest in women-led companies. And the thesis is to basically invest in tech-enabled companies that are women-led or are focused on the woman consumer. So companies, you know, that are basically promoting women entrepreneurship, women engagement, and women employers. So that's Saha Fund's thesis. It's an early stage fund where we make, seed and pre-series A investments. So our investment sizes can range anywhere from, one CR to six CR during. So we invest in pre-series A and then we follow on in a series A. So that's how we are invest basically in Saha Fund. And I'm actually currently just launching my second women fund, which is going to have a global focus, India, UK, US. And the idea is, again, so there's so many women-led companies out there, which of course I feel have global similarities, but there are local nuances. So looking at femtech, future of work, fintech, and education tech.
Okay, cool. That's a lot going on. Rahul, you have been a VC in India probably longer than anyone else I know. maybe one or two other people. And you've kind of seen, you know, multiple.
I was a VC before I knew I was a VC.
Yeah. Most of us didn't even know what VC was back then, right? Or how to spell it. So you know, you've seen a lot of cycles, a lot of hype, a lot of disappointment, and you know, over time, you've seen the infrastructure across venture and startups kind of really build up and solidify, right? And you know, you've run multiple funds during that time. So could you tell us a little bit about your current fund and you know, how you got here and what is the thesis? I know it's a very different thesis than Helion and Unitary Helion, but you know, for the audience, let's dive into a little bit about why you chose a very different thesis rather than the broad-based B2B, B2C folks that a lot of the other funds have taken.
Sure, Pankaj. Thanks for having me. I you know, still remember the falafel we had around the NYU campus a couple of years back. It'd be good to repeat that sometime in the future.
Yes.
So we rebranded Unitary Helion, which is you know, what the working title was, into Arkham Ventures. ARKAM. And you're right, Arkham is very different from Helion, which is a fund that came about in 2006. Markets were a little different back then. We felt that India is ready for, I guess, going a little bit more deeper than just staying more horizontal, which means that things that we know well, things that have worked well, things where we have seen success in the past, why not double down on those? And obviously the trade-off is that, you know, either at some point we say that, you know, this fund can become a $250 million fund just by this focus, or we'll have to, you know, go back and tell our LPs, no, that, you know, we are giving up and we feel that, you know, there is need to go more horizontal. Because, you know, in all VC businesses, there's always this upward trend of, you know, funds that are being managed, fund sizes that need to be raised. But, you know, we felt this was the time to actually double down on what we thought has worked. And that was one reason. And if you circle what has worked for us, it was, you know, one learning that if you take away all the low-cost capital that investors provide to startups in India, you know, then the staying power, the monetization, the growth by itself actually peters out very quickly. If you are focused on the market, which is the top 15, 20 million, let's call them well-to-do Indians. So we had experiences where we've seen billion-dollar IPOs come out of the investments when we made for the middle India. And this we felt was the most underserved and the you know, and the largest market opportunity. And we felt that post UPI and Aadhaar, there was you know, a nice set of digital rails that public utility had built for us to access customers in this market. So we felt that let's go after the, you know, the bulk of the wallet share, which was in three buckets, actually four buckets: fintech, health tech, food and agri, mobility and logistics. And these are, as you can tell, are fairly necessary, essential spends that any household will make in middle India. So we felt that here we can actually find companies that can scale by the pull of what they're providing, not by the push of, you know, needing to acquire customers at expensive CACs and, you know, then try and build economic models to work around that. We felt that it would be easier to find scale and build companies that can last and sustain themselves longer. Pankaj, you're muted.
Sorry about that. So I know you've done one investment out of the new fund already. Could you share a little bit about that particular investment?
Sure. Actually, we have now six investments. So the last quarter has been.
So COVID lockdown has kept you quite busy. And,
besides growing this, I'm also investing. I can talk a little bit about the flavor of, you know, and why this and how this translates into some of these exciting startups. So we have invested in one of the larger digital lending platforms a little bit, you know, actually before COVID happened. But it is the one company we feel has done a very good job of converting thin credit files for Middle India into thicker credit files. So there's a much better credit view on customers from Middle India based on the way they have done it at scale. You know, they have 1.5 million customers and they're growing and generating more data than we have seen get generated about Middle India. Second one is Jumbotail, which is a B2B agri supply chain company, which provides you know, delivery of branded and unbranded items for Kirana stores, which is 98% of where India shops still, despite, you know, some great brands like Big Basket. So that's what we feel that is going to be an essential place where most of Middle India is going to continue to buy their grocery and daily essentials from. Third one that we have announced is Jai Kisan. It is a team that has actually put together a model that solves a lot of the agri issues that have been challenging so far. Most of it was around end use. A lot of agri loan goes into the market, but there is no linkage at all between making sure that that money is going into actually producing an agricultural outcome. It could very well go into spending on a motorbike or a wedding. So the revenue generation that is happening at a farmer end is if you link your loan to that, there has to be an outcome at the end of the day. And there is a, you know, pretty high quality loan right there, because, you know, once the farmer sells the harvest, there is a cash flow which you can then get your return from. But for this, you need to tie up with the, you know, the distribution, the companies that are part of this value chain. And the way Jai Kisan has done it is, you know, a very strong integration with various players, including lenders, but also the equipment manufacturers, the fertilizer manufacturers, which, you know, these companies have a very, I guess, a clear view, strong view, distribution capability. That's one side of the loans. And the other side is the working capital side, where a farmer can, you know, generally tied up to a, you know, a company that is, you know, doing contract farming. So let's say chips for Lay's, you have to harvest the potatoes and, you know, Lay's will buy most of that produce. That working capital gap is what this company can go and then fund, because, you know, there is again a very finite outcome at the end of the harvesting cycle. So that's the third one. And the others I'll cover quickly. One is in the health tech space. We believe digitization is really pushing, is getting pushed by hospitals. There are about a lakh and a half, 150,000 hospitals in India. Most of them have underspent on tech, and the, you know, COVID has really been a good incentive for most of them to drive harder on digitizing their services. I mean, we normally spend 90 minutes on a 10-minute consultation. And, you know, it's a big loss of revenue for hospitals, and this company is pushing harder to actually make that patient flow more efficient. The other one is a digital banking API company. It's deployed already with most of the major banks. And we see, again, a very strong push by the banking sector in India to adopt digitization. And we are seeing growth in this one as well. So we feel there is a, you know, I think a good basket of companies now that we have put together, which are mirroring the thesis that I just talked about.
Interesting. Okay, you have for the last couple of years focused on women entrepreneurs. Are you seeing more women entrepreneurs targeting the type of middle India that Rahul's talking about, or, you know, are you still seeing more and more companies focusing on the tier one cities across India that we've seen over the last 5-10 years?
No, actually, I mean, whatever Rahul is talking about, that thesis. So we see actually a lot of women-led companies targeting that segment. For example, as I'd mentioned to you, one of the companies in our portfolio is Love Local, which is called Empani before. But they also basically help Kirana stores go digital, right? So they started off as being a loyalty program for Kirana stores, providing that dashboard for them to be able to manage their inventory, attract customers, create loyalty. Now they've also extended into last mile delivery of essential goods. But basically they've created a platform for Kirana stores to basically go digital and be online in Bombay and expanding to other parts of India. But of course, I think, and then we have one company, which is Fraternity, which is into basically, I think it's India's largest online platform for wellness options around you. Looking at gyms. So now they've also actually added on kind of diagnostics and clinics. So I think the India story is the consumer story. And I think majority of that consumer is middle India, as Rahul was talking. So, and a lot of the companies that we see, so we also had a company called Go Co-op in our portfolio, which basically has helped artisans and cooperatives, again, go online, right? 80% of them are women-led. So we've seen so many of those trends in small and medium businesses being women-led and women-focused.
So there's an opportunity here, I see, between the two of you to kind of help each other out with some co-investing.
Absolutely. Look forward to that. Thanks.
Yeah. So, a question for both of you, and kind of what we really want to discuss today is, the rise of first-time managers and new funds that have been popping up, especially in the last 3 to 4 years. And kind of what your views are on what's driving a lot of the new funds, where is the money coming from? One of the biggest challenges that I think, Rahul, you can probably talk to this very well, was early on, there wasn't a whole lot of domestic capital available for a venture fund in India, right? So a lot of the money was coming from overseas. Today, you have lots of domestic capital, as well as Chinese, Japanese, European money pouring into India, maybe not as much American, but on a relative basis. But even Middle East money is coming in. So, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what's really driving all of these new funds. Where are they going to raise money from? How are they differentiating their thesis from existing funds that have been doing this for 10 years, right? Like, and specifically at the early stage, I think late stage is a whole different ball game and is probably a whole nother hour-long discussion to have. So, let's hear from you guys what your thoughts are.
Go for it, Angel. I'll follow you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in 2015, when I launched, SAHA Fund, there I realized there was this whole rise of the new angel investor, right? I think it was a lot of the new generation coming into, their family offices, managing their money. And there was this availability of new cash available for seed stage startups, at least. So at that time, you saw so much of that happening. And of course, that was a time of, really high valuations as well. But a lot of the early stage funds, I think, have also come about from exits that have happened. And, so you have these new entrepreneurs who have now become fund managers as well. And as I mentioned, a lot of family office. I mean, there's new capital also available. So, of course, I think still India lacks, investors coming in at the late stage, looking at a late series B or a series C or a series D. But there's suddenly a lot of, I think, domestic capital, at least available for the early stage segment. Venture capital on the whole, I mean, I personally still feel for an investor in India is still quite nascent, because I feel a lot of the large, kind of ultra HNIs and, the large business houses, of course, they first want to invest in themselves. And then a lot of it goes into, say, real estate or the stock market, and private equity, and of course, venture capital then. So a lot of it has now, I think there's a lot more awareness, and there's more, family office, which is coming into the play, investing into these early stage funds. But yeah, I mean, I think today's fund manager is someone who's been a successful entrepreneur slash operator. And also being able to kind of build, you know, say a more kind of global exposed team, and really looking at, you know, solutions that really be scaled up across markets, right? Because something you build can, in India can go abroad, and something abroad can come here. So yeah, it's a diverse set.
Cool. Okay. Rahul, what are your thoughts?
So this morning, actually, I was speaking to somebody, you know, we connected on LinkedIn, but the place where I saw them was, you know, a deal announcement, and then there was this fund in Delhi, which actually has only individuals as investors, but it is structured like a fund, and I don't know if it's a on-call capital or is it a dedicated pool of capital, but I ended up speaking to one of the individuals in that fund this morning. And Pankaj, I was blown away by the, you know, so this person was in Ahmedabad. His family is in the real estate business. And he took a break from that. No big family office. So it is not like he doesn't know what to do with all the money he has, and that's why he's investing. But he's actually thinking in a more mature way about how to progress, you know, what is at this moment more of a personal portfolio. He already knows, you know, how to, you know, how he has progressed to becoming a syndicate leader, how he will set up a seed fund. So I think in so many minds, and by the way, this is in Ahmedabad, like I mentioned. So it's amazing how well understood this pattern is in terms of make a few investments, get some results, and then pool more capital. So what is driving this person obviously is his sense of how much capital is around and available to him, maybe in his immediate proximity in Ahmedabad. But that's how, you know, I think things are just adding up to, you know, what I think is an amazing level of activity in India. In the afternoon, I spoke to Rajiv at Antler, which is, you know, already in 11 countries. He's an ex, like, you know, like you mentioned, he's an ex-entrepreneur, he's an open clap. So the kind of people coming in to now get startups going, the early stages, with the kind of lessons that entrepreneurs have had, it's just phenomenal. You know, and of course, you know, there's a massive pool that that is waiting to, you know, to actually first pitch deck that we made at Helion in 2005 actually had a map of where do we stand, you know, who's doing what, and there were, I think, only five. There was no Matrix, there was no Nexus, there was only Westbridge and a couple of other funds, and we just had a very simple here we are. We are a fund founders for founders, and you know, we like to think from, you know, founder first perspective. And when I look at, you know, things now, it's beginning to look a lot like, or at least beginning to early signs of what happened in China. In 2014, you know, till then, from 2006, when China also started on the venture journey, most of the, or all of the capital was USD. So it was a dollar funding VC funds in China. And then in 14, the renminbi backed funds actually overshot the total AUM of USD funds. So the domestic capital started, you know, year after year, it was stacking higher than what USD funds were. So domestic capital finally, you know, came together. I think, you know, there's a challenge, as again, we have talked about, where the size of this capital may not be enough to fall in the risk category. But if you compare, you know, our first slide and what's happening now, just look at how, you know, how many more entrepreneurs can get that first capital, second capital, and get going. And suddenly you have a institutionally backed or a organized capital, not borrowed money from parents or uncles. Here there are people evaluating the best deals in a, you know, in a fairly intuitive and mature manner. And, you know, again, this is a massive jump from 2012, Pankaj, when I would be part of business plan competitions all over the country, which didn't have anything other than prize money, you know. So the process has now become like, you come to a syndicate, we look at you as a, you know, with real dollars, with real INR, and we will actually put a check in. So you know, it's I think the childhood game has now become, you know, real, and it's actually happening all over. So it's very, very exciting.
So do you think the maturity is coming because we're seeing more successful exits? Do you think the maturity is coming because there's just more awareness and better education around starting and running a company? You know, what do you think is driving this? I mean, from the exit side, I don't think that there have been enough exits across the Indian ecosystem. So I don't think.
I absolutely agree. I think they are, but there are still quite a few. You know, think about it. Infosys was the only large outcome of a tech company in 2006. So we had nothing to show. And Daksh was the other one which IBM had acquired. So there were, you know, maybe three or four. Make My Trip had not happened by then. Now, if you again,
Naukri.
Naukri had gone public. I think so. It had gone public. Yes, but I still feel while there are quite a few examples, they aren't enough to drive people to, you know, get their checkbooks out because they have not seen that capital come back. Yeah. So there is no flow of returns on their past investments that are happening. I think what's like what even VC firms are banking on is the potential, and people are consuming these services. So I take an Ola. Ola is a venture-backed company. It started, you know, with two taxis, or I order on Big Basket. These were three entrepreneurs who started in one room. So I think that story, you know, where you are actually seeing a Big Basket sitting next to a Reliance or an Amazon, and you know, you think backwards and say, okay, I could have been an investor in a company that is, you know, a household name. I think that opportunity is what is driving a lot of this capital.
But you know, at the end of the day, people want to see some sort of return, right? And I think a lot of angel investors that have gotten in early have seen returns because of secondaries. Predominantly secondaries, but in some cases, smaller exits. I think the sub $100 million exits are becoming a little bit more frequent. You know, 20 to 50 million, I think, is kind of the bulge bracket of where acquisitions are happening. But you know, I still think that the returns part of it, it's a tough story to sell, right? And you know, the whole yes, there's a lot of potential. That's a story that we've been hearing and telling for a very long time, right? But it's still something that hasn't come to fruition, right? So you know, I think that the long-term potential is massive, but at the same time, the proof points are far and few between, right? And as a fund manager, and having spoken to many other emerging fund managers, you know, how do you sell that story to institutional LPs? How do you sell that story to high net worth individuals that have been watching it, perhaps have been early investors? You know, Ankita, you're in the process of going out for your second fund now, and just raised money. So, you know, what's the story here? I mean, how is the story changing, or is it the same story that, you know, some of us were telling in 2010, 2012?
I mean, just from my perspective, I can speak kind of running a woman led fund. I think for me, for the first fund, there were two stories. One was the India story, which I think it's still a very exciting story, right? I mean, of course, you know, so we've had the Flipkart exit, et cetera. And I think the Indian consumer story is exciting for people, right? In India and outside of India, people want to diversify and come into Asia, and so they look at China and they look at India, and they want to get into India right now as well, right? What's also, I mean, for my fund, a lot of the people who invested, they really wanted to back diversity and inclusion, right? They want women to be part of the workforce. They want women to lead the change, and that's why therefore they have invested, right? Because pretty much 50% of your population is women, but why is only 5 to 7% still being funded, if at all, right? So my investor set is something, I mean, are people who are really passionate about, I think, investing in innovation, they really want India to accelerate their innovation, their startups, and also kind of, you know, take traction on the kind of middle India consumer story, but also, you know, really promote women-led investments, right? So I think from that perspective, it's still interesting. Of course, as you mentioned, there are exits, but we can't compare to the exits and the quantum of exits that we have in countries like the US. But I think we're still a very interesting market. And I think India is known for also frugal innovation, right? You know, we have great tech that we have built out, you know, at very low costs, which is also very interesting, right? So how can we take this innovation into other markets? It's still very interesting. And I think something which can definitely be scaled up. So I think that's why it's still interesting for an investor.
And the way we have, you know, what we have told our LPs, Pankaj, is obviously, you know, every investor would want to look at your past track record. You know, in some ways, at least what I can count are, you know, 6 exits out of 14 investments. And I'm able to show that the balance, other than the ones that have that no longer exist, there is a very clear path to exit as well. So, you know, LPs would generally look at, you know, 2 things. First would be, is it meaningful enough to generate a return on the fund? And, you know, on a fund which is smaller, that is obviously relatively easier compared to a much larger fund. So there is enough evidence of that happening in India where markups are actually looking good to show that kind of return. If you look at, you know, Helion track record, you know, we are able to show, you know, those kind of returns that have happened in the past. There've been exits, there've been IPOs, strategic sales. So, you know, I think that in pockets, you will find capital returns happening. The other thing that would get kicked around, you know, the tires would get kicked around for is, you know, is that valuation simply a creation without any backing? So investors would be discerning enough to correlate whether, you know, this valuation is way out of whack for where the revenue is or where, you know, the metrics are. And so there'll be some kind of a linkage between your valuation story and your, you know, reality of that. So I think in terms of money back per se, I would just say there are pockets that have done that. But it is not, definitely not like, you know, all of India is generating a lot of liquidity for LPs. I think there is a reason for that. And the reason is that I think the secular growth in India that was happening till about 14 from, you know, almost barring 2008, almost gave the sense that, you know, businesses are going to grow a lot of VCs actually ignored exit possibilities because they thought the next year is going to be better. And the offer was, hey, it's not large enough. We can make more. Let's stay in. So a lot of, you know, opportunities came and VCs just tended to push out their exits. So partly I think it is linked to that. And then, of course, things happened, which was, so the orientation of a VC to say, I need to get an exit. Let me find a buyer, even if it's a secondary fund. You know, let me find ways in which I can actually get money back to my investors. That was pushed back, you know, just to say, okay, we are compounding every year, even if it's 20%, that's good. But the need for liquidity was just felt a little bit less. And of course, you know, the cows came home, and you know, now of course it's a very pronounced requirement by LPs. And you know, they're saying the same thing about China. Liquidity from China is also, you know, nothing to talk about.
Who are, you know, some of the funds, the newer funds that both of you have been kind of tracking and keeping an eye on or perhaps starting to work with? And, you know, what is it about these funds that has made working with them enjoyable for you guys?
So
so I mean, sorry.
Go ahead, Rao. So some of the new names, Pankaj, would be Venture Highway. They've had, I guess, good access to quality seed companies. You can by and large tell from their general mix of founder quality. I think they're also linked a lot to YC. And in general, the businesses are quite exciting. I think in terms of working relationships, not new, but Bloom is has certainly metamorphosized quite a bit over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
They're far more involved in their businesses, and they're writing bigger checks to back their early ones. So continues to be a great relationship there. Venture Catalyst is another one that I'm beginning to see a lot of. And zero to one
pennies.
Yeah. I think they're also doing several good investments, in, especially in the SaaS space.
Hmm. Cool. Okay. Ankita, who are some of the funds that you started working with or have been tracking? And
I mean, the early stage. Some of the early stage funds that we've been kind of working with. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So one of them is, I think, Pi Ventures, which has a great, AI.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Hello?
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's okay.
Yes, yeah. So I think Pi Ventures is very interesting because they've been looking at deep tech AI-led companies. You know, one company which is very interesting, which we wanted to kind of co-invest with them, was Nirmay, which is doing stuff in the cancer detection area. And I think what's also interesting is, Fireside Ventures, which is investing in the consumer growth story of India, creating brands for India.
Yeah.
I think they're also very interesting. We've also co-invested along with Bloom and Sixth Sense Ventures again. So I think they're all doing some interesting stuff for the India kind of brand and consumer story, which is very interesting.
Okay. Who are some of the folks that you guys have started meeting recently that are, you don't have to name names, but that are in the process of thinking about raising a fund or raising a fund? And what is some of the advice that you might have given to some of these folks? Raul, you want to start?
Certainly to show clarity of thought in terms of where the capital is going to be deployed. Why is that a differentiated story? Number two, I would say a lot of questions are asked about, are you going to get crushed by elephants, with your small check size? So, are you going to look at, things which are more capital efficient, or are you going to, look at the more high burn consumer side businesses? I think that's a very big question most LPs have. And in terms of actual practical, while you are at it, the best thing to do is to to keep investing and, either warehouse these or write smaller checks, but to be able to showcase real companies that are reflecting the thesis, there is no better argument than to actually show a portfolio. And the sooner a fund does that, the closer they get to getting commitments.
Okay, nice. Ankita, I'm sure lots of other folks have approached you also, and there's a couple of women who are entering VC right now that have reached out to me that are perhaps tuned in today, and a lot of them are looking for women mentors. So I'm sure some of them have reached out to you to ask you, how do they get started in VC? How do they raise a fund? What's some of the advice that you have given to them or would give to them?
Yeah, I mean, so just in the recent past, yeah, I know, so there are people who are kind of coming out with accelerator programs or smaller check sizes funds, right? So I think what's important is focus. You know, I mean, for example, just from my learning, I think in my fund one, you know, we invested in woman-led companies and, you know, companies that were creating something for the woman consumer, but we didn't really have much of a sector focus. So I think so now for the fund too, right, we're looking very, very closely at, you know, future of work. It's always been a theme that I've been looking at. Of course, now future of work is the new normal, but technologies that are enabling future of work and enabling people to, you know, work from home, flexible job options, et cetera. Looking at femtech, looking at inclusive finance and edtech. So I think one of the learnings is that, you know, to have a focus within the portfolio as well, which is complementary. Also, I think it's really important, you know, to be able to have a path to an exit as well, right? So I think it's really important that you invest in businesses that, you know, definitely, you know, they've raised or are raising smart capital, you know, have the vision to really scale up and exit. I think that's very important, right? A lot of times some companies think it's okay just to raise the first two or three rounds of capital, but they don't necessarily think about exit. So I think that's very important. And also just from an LP perspective, you know, talking with LPs and of course fundraising, I think they also like focus. They also like to know, how are we really helping build these companies, right? What is our network? What partners do we have on board? What are we really adding value? What markets are we opening up? So if you can show that, and of course, you know, as Rahul said, you know, have a portfolio, invest well, build a track record, of course, from your past, but within the new portfolio, right? I think that makes a huge difference and gives comfort to the LPs. And I guess it's great pointers for people who are currently trying to raise a fund as well, right? I think relevant experience, having a focus in mind is all very helpful.
Wow, great advice. Wish somebody gave me that advice a couple of years ago. We got a question from Grishman. The role of diversification in the VC industry. Now, I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to, but let's talk about, you know, within the workplace, right? On the VC, the GP side, diversification on that side. Now, you know.
Is it diversity or diversification? Seems like he's comparing it to the public market, but if you want to talk about diversity, I'm game as well.
Let's talk about diversity first, and then maybe we'll go into diversification after that.
Sure.
Okay, so on a diversity side, right, yeah, you're right. I just saw this other comment about public markets. But on the diversity side, let's talk about that on the GP. You know, a lot of the fund managers, at least the ones that I've come across with, you know, are a lot of men. There are relatively fewer women at most GPs. You know, when you go to a conference, most of the people that you meet are men. You know, how are both of you thinking about diversity within your funds and your organizations, both from a portfolio construction perspective and also from a from an organizational perspective, right? Like, as an organization, is diversity an important part of building your business out? And how are you approaching it? So, Ankita, let's start with you because, you know, yours is a little interesting. You are already diverse, but now, yeah. What does diversity mean to you as you're building your organization and your portfolio?
So, of course, I mean, Saha Fund is a diversity focused fund from the fact that, of course, we're two women co-founders, again, looking at women-led and women-focused companies. But, you know, diversity, I think what's important is also the portfolio companies themselves also thinking and implementing diversity, right? So, I mean, I think it's great to think about it, but it's also really important to act upon it. I mean, just to give you an example, right? So One of our companies was doing a huge kind of hiring drive and you know, interviewing people for a particular role. And they had probably, you know, like hundreds of people show up and, you know, both men and women, and they gave offers to equal number of men and women. But then people who actually signed up were pretty much only the men. I think out of maybe, whatever, 50 people, just two women actually signed up and joined the job. And then they realized that so far in the past, for all their hiring drives, the people who have been interviewing these people have all been men. So in their next drive, in their hiring drive, they actually made sure that there were women there as well interviewing. And believe it or not, 50% women actually joined the role, right? So that's the importance of diversity. I think employers and corporations need to provide that comfort for women to come to work and feel comfortable about the fact that they will be understood, there will be an environment for them to be able to speak and, you know, really engage, right? So I think, you know, diversity is, you know, led by example. So, you know, senior management hires, senior management themselves have to be representative of that. You know, small things, like, for example, I had, you know, when I had gone to meet Shikha Sharma of Axis Bank at that time, you know, their head office in Bombay, their ground floor has a huge play school and creche. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, how come you guys have this? And they were like, oh, because we have so many women employees, right? They actually leave their kids there. And because of that, we've had so many women actually join and be part of the bank, right? So small things like these, which we don't, maybe might not think they're important, but they make a huge difference when to really attract talent, you know, especially women-led talent. So I think that's what diversity is. You know, it's very important to create that kind of environment for women employees, women entrepreneurs, to be able to create and inspire and lead by example.
So Ankita, Raul, before we jump to you, I'll get a question. Homogenous society, in the sense that, you know, you know, you're not going to have a lot of different racial diversity in India. There is some, especially in the Northeast and all, but for the most part, it's a fairly homogenous society. So beyond the gender diversity, what other type of diversity do you think about for your organization and for your portfolio?
I mean, of course, as you said, I think in India, it's limited. But of course, you know, there's so much happening outside of India. So for example, for our next global fund, you know, we are looking at racial diversity as well, right? You know, there's a fund, I forget the name, but, you know, I think last year he just launched his first fund, which is, I think, a small $50 million fund. I think just day before I read that he's now been able to raise $300 million. So I think it's very important. So in the US, for example, there is so much happening, even from the academic level itself, right? When you're applying for undergrad or graduation, you know, Hispanic, Asian, whatever it may be, right? So I think it's very important to have racial diversity because culture and experience and global exposure also is a huge value add, which sometimes you don't realize. But I think having cultural and racial diversity is a huge plus as well. I think this all brings about positive culture within the organization.
Yeah. Okay. Rahul, what are your thoughts on diversity at Arkham?
Right now we are four men, so we are as far removed from diversity as we can be. But you know, it's not like we actually, when we get together, we are not talking about cricket scores or, you know, or whiskeys and cigars. And, you know, I think we're probably talking about, you know, children issues or admissions, stuff at home. So, you know, I think from a culture, we are not trying to make it an alpha male. And thankfully, VC is a lot about collaboration, right? And at the end of the day, you know, we are used to the, you know, to making the best decisions out of a whole bunch of thought processes that, you know, people bring. Diversity is actually a strength in VC because, you know, finally you want to, you know, amalgamate several different ways of looking at the world, looking at businesses. And I think so investing in diversity has a very finite outcome in VC. But like you said, Pankaj, in India, there is, you know, that type of limitation. In in how much you can do it. But I guess first step first, when we looked recently for people on the investment team, I would say we would have liked to, we didn't make an extra effort to reach out to, you know, making sure, and this was our first hire. So, like Ankita mentioned, focused on making sure that there was an equal representation between men and women. In the end, you know, it was a pretty low ratio. It was, I think, 2 women out of 10 men who applied. So, you know, we would have loved to see a higher ratio, even 4 out of 10 would have been great. But for the next hire, we are definitely going to make sure that we are making that happen versus, you know, just letting the cards fall.
That's good. And there are a few women I could definitely introduce you to that would be a great fit. So when you're ready to hire, let me know.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's get to diversification since I misread that. So, diversification in the VC industry and kind of relative to public markets, or how is it different from public markets? Do you guys want to talk about how you approach portfolio construction? I mean, that's the broader question here, right? You want to start, Ankita?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of our portfolio and, you know, looking at how we kind of allocate it, in terms of early stage, so we're looking at our early stage investments, our first round of investments, and I mean, just in a venture capital portfolio, we look at what we want to back in the first round and keep for follow on, but also we want to. So I mean, of course, it depends. I think each fund has its own strategy. One is a very focused strategy, but I think you can also within the portfolio look at specific sectors. But also, I think for us, what's important is technology and how we apply technology to these sectors, right? So I think it's very important that we, even though we diversify by a certain industry and looking at different sectors, what brings them in common, what is being leveraged across them is very important, right? Because you want the portfolio itself also to benefit from some kind of common platform. And I think a focus in the portfolio also allows you to bring in great, you know, kind of experts and advisors and mentors on board to add value to your portfolio.
Okay.
So diversity obviously is how two assets are correlated. If one goes down, what is the likelihood of the other going down? At the LP level, there is already diversity in play because if they're investing in a certain stage of VC in India, they're very unlikely to do too many of those. So I think by default, that also comes to investors in India, where there are not too many similar assets that they would take exposure to. So, you know, that is one level of diversity that's happening at the investor level. In our level, in our portfolio, of course, there is almost equal risk when we are starting off for all companies to succeed or fail. At least that's what we would like to achieve. So there is not that much role of diversity within a VC portfolio that you can effectively then try and achieve results like you would in a public market portfolio. But would, for example, a Sequoia would do multiple investments in the same category, let's say EdTech or FinTech. We have experienced this in the past, and sometimes you like the theme a lot, and it is not a winner take all thesis. And there you would like to perhaps back one more play, if there is no direct competition. So there is less pronounced, let's not do one more of the same. Because if it's working, then you want to do more of those, especially if they're not competing with each other.
Yeah, I think the flip side is kind of a 500 startups type of model where there's intense diversification, right? You're almost creating an index of the startup world, and you're investing in a lot of different companies across many different sectors, across different geographies. And in some cases, different stages also, right? Like when I was at 500, we did some very late stage deals as well as some very early stage deals. And you know, there are pros and cons to that model as well. But you know, that's the other extreme of diversification, right?
And by default, it has to be a very large portfolio.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, when I left 500 at the end of 2016, I think the portfolio globally across all of the different funds was around 1,700 companies in the portfolio. You know, just my portfolio was about 85 companies that I personally had invested in.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the other extreme of diversification, right? And you are naturally less hands-on when you have such large portfolios. So we have another question from Mrinalini. Essentially, she's asking, as more downstream investors come upstream and start writing larger checks at earlier stages, you know, is it creating more competition for early stage funds to get into the best deals? So who wants to take this one?
I can go first. So these are obviously, you know, the names you have, Axel and Sequoia, they've always been in early stage. I think Axel is doing now slightly more later stage, but that's also a different Axel. It's an Axel late stage fund. So it is not a movement, but yes, there was a time when, you know, a hedge fund would come and write a Series A check of, you know, 10 million. Those are times where, of course, it's a sign of the time rather than, you know, that particular deal, because it's happening across the board because there is so much frothiness in, you know, how risk is perceived in early stage. So those are, you know, periods, and, you know, just like the economy, very clear troughs and crests in the VC investment cycle also. There's always, you know, a peak, and then there is always a fall. So, you know, somehow, you know, if you go back 20 years, the fall is the best, you know, the best phase to actually make your best returns. The best performing funds happen during the times where fewer people are investing. So I think it's a pattern that's been happening for the last 20 years.
Yeah. Okay, though, you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of access to capital and what it means for the pipeline, I think it all depends, again, on your focus and also your network. I think, again, from my perspective, you know, there was a lot of access to deals that we got just by being, you know, the first of its kind. And of course, the focus that we have. Also, in my case, for example, we co-invested, you know, on deals with the IDG. So at that time, they were not looking at seed stage too much. They had just in their new fund at that time, I think, carved out 20% or so for seed. So there was a lot of deal sharing happening as well. So I think it was complementary for our fund from that perspective, because we did two deals together at that point. So I think you know, it all depends on your network and relationship within the industry, your focus. And of course, you know, I mean, you know, over time, there will be a track record which you build and a name that you have. And then people will know that they want to come to you for their capital because they know that, you know, you will add value to their business. And I think that's what a smart entrepreneur will look for.
Yeah. Okay. I know we're a little bit over time. I have two more questions for both of you before we wrap it up, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So in your opinions, what areas of the Indian venture community need significant improvements or changes?
I think one is, so your point, Pankaj, really, the way I would read it is, what can VC firms do better?
Yes.
This
can be a broad question, you know, what can a VC firm do better in terms of helping the overall ecosystem, or it can be what can they do for their portfolio companies better, so that's more micro, and anything in between, right? So it's really, it's a very broad question, and I purposely am asking a very broad question so that, you know, you could put it into your context and kind of see like, hey, you know, this is what I see wrong with this industry, or, you know, other firms aren't doing as well, and this is how I want to do this differently, right? So yeah. Sorry to cut you off.
Sure. No, thanks. That was helpful. So I would say that, you know, again, despite everything and the excitement and the number of funds we are seeing, the specialized funds are very far and few. And, you know, so some sectors, you know, which are best understood by practitioners or by people who have come from that sector, let's say, you know, something in biotech, drug discovery, or you know, medicine delivery, that's an initiative that is quite lacking in India, and it may be, you know, that it's just where we are at this point of the cycle. And going forward, there'll be people with successes in these spaces. So, you know, I think there is a SaaS fund that's coming together, which is only going to do SaaS. Like Emergent in the US, Emergence, they, you know, they only did SaaS, and they, you know, picked some really good deals. I think it's a factor of how much depth you can get from just chasing one. That's one. I think more tactically, VCs in India tend to, you know, actually most investors in India tend to do less referencing before they invest than they should, I think. So a lot of, you know, a lot of misdeeds get forgiven by a second check that happens. And those misdeeds could be, you know, where the founder has not been fully honest with how he ran the company, so on and so forth. So I think some of that back channel through references, you know, you can just make sure that the, you know, the best quality people who have actually worked, you know, very hard to, you know, deliver returns for their investors. Because there are some pockets still, you know, where raising money seems to be the be all and end all. Whereas, you know, if, like you said, if you don't have exits, if you're not giving money back, you know, this flow is going to get more and more challenging. The LPs will start questioning, and then, you know, the party has to stop at some point.
So I mean, you mentioned calling people out. Do you mean publicly or at least within?
Just a quiet reference call. You know, before you invest in someone, just call, you know, people who have known them in the past, find out how they've dealt with their employees. You know, were they good managers, good leaders? You know, were they, you know, were the numbers are kosher or not?
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced that too, where, you know, I've had conversations with people and would get a very positive opinion of a certain founder, or even in some cases, other investors. And then later on, you find out like, well, that wasn't really accurate. Yeah. Or it was complete opposite of accurate, actually. I agree. I think that's a...
Then once the funding happens, no one wants to talk about it because your money is already at stake.
Yeah. Good point. I'll get that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what as VCs, generally what we can do is also, I think, work closely with corporates to really bring about, I think, innovation. And we have some very deep, I mean, as Rahul mentioned, specialized funds with, you know, kind of deep research and innovation happening there. But kind of working with partners already, whether it be corporate partners or other institutions, which not only bring about, you know, say, innovation, but also a path to exit for the portfolio, right? I think if you do that more in a more disciplined, streamlined manner, it'll be good for the overall portfolio. Of course, there's very limited what that we can... influence regulation in India. But I think for the VC environment itself on the whole, if it was more pro-business and the regulations were more in favor of what we're doing, that would be great as well for the VC environment. And I think, of course, I agree with Rahul as well in terms of doing more robust due diligence. I think a lot of times some of the deals come from very known close networks, given how close and, you know, small the ecosystem is. And sometimes we might miss out on doing some more deeper due diligence, right? Which might backfire later. So I think all these things is something that we can look at.
Fair enough. I think we can run another hour with additional conversation and questions. But Before we end the stream, I want to just ask both of you for some advice, both for founders that want to contact you and work with you. What is some advice that you can give them before they approach you? And some advice to other emerging managers or people that are running syndicates on AngelList and want to kind of graduate to becoming a VC manager. So two pieces of advice. Ankita, you want to continue?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just from the, I think for entrepreneurs and founders, just I think advice is that, you know, really look into, you know, first of all, build or you know, create a solution which is unique, which is actually solving, you know, a real world or real market problem, which can really be scaled up. Because only when it's really scalable, really solving a problem, is it that it's venture investable as well, right? That's very important. And also to kind of look up your investor before you pitch. You know, there's always a particular investor out there for you. You know, do your research, do your, you know, put your effort in when you're looking for the right investor. And also, I mean, you know, before you put it, you go to an investor, it's good to kind of showcase that you have a team, people believing in your idea. You have some relevant advisors and mentors on board, and not just people on your website, but people who are actually adding value to your company and working with you, right? I think all that makes a difference. And I think for new managers who are raising money out there, again, you know, I think it's good to, I feel, to have a focus, to have a team in place which has, you know, the right elements, whether if you're, you know, the technology, global exposure, entrepreneurial experience. I think it's very important for both founders and for fund managers to have that entrepreneurial, I think, you know, passion and characteristic and zest to, I think, really build it out, right? And I think for both founders and fund managers, a network is really important. You know, networking, meeting people, you know, talking about your ideas, getting people to believe in you, I think that makes a difference.
Great advice. Raul?
Yeah, most good founders don't need advice, and I like that situation the best, because we have very little to give. But I would give two at the cost of you know, speaking too much. One would be where, you know, I think that what Jeff Bezos does at Amazon, I'm going to use that, which is day one. I think that's very, very important, irrespective of where you are on the funding cycle. Maybe you've got a, you know, $200 million valuation. But I think it's very important to be, you know, let's use the word humble, in just saying that, you know, there is a lot of paths to go. Yet, you know, I think the ambition shouldn't be, you know, more when fundraising, but it should also be on a daily basis.
Yeah.
When you're hiring people, you know, the kind and quality of people, when you're dealing with your employees, it is not a short journey, it is a very long journey. You know, dealing with customers, same story, dealing with investors, same story. So day one actually helps you recalibrate a lot of relationships as well, besides just feeling excited and energetic. It just says that you are in it for the long haul and everybody else is there. It's going to be around for a long time as well. I think for managers, I think a lot of deals are happening where you know, the round is coming together like a club deal. You know, there is either a round where nobody has any room to come in because one big check has come in, or there is, you know, four or five investors writing smaller checks to put a round of 15 million together. I think so. What it means is that we all need to reach out a lot and understand, you know, check sizes, call each other, you know, use each other's diligence, move quickly on deals, because I think the ecosystem clearly is, you know, either, you know, very large funds or, you know, funds which are not large, right, which have to write checks in the sub $5 million range. So I think there has to be a better ecosystem in making sure we all, you know, understand and work together and find ways to, you know, to do things together more proactively than not.
Okay, cool.
I agree. Yeah.
Thank you both. If you want to continue, I'm free to continue, but you know, it's dinner time and family and all that. So thank you both for doing this. I think it was a great conversation, and I definitely learned a lot from both of you. If you guys want to hang out for a couple of seconds afterwards, I'm just going to end the live stream and we could just wrap up behind the scenes.
Well, thank you, Pankaj. Thanks. Awesome. Really enjoyed this.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pankaj, for having us. It was great. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks again for joining us on InvestStream Live. Next week, we are doing a fireside chat with Rob Goh from NextView Ventures, based out of Boston and New York City. So join us then. Thanks.